all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. I do want to comment on Radio on the River, which was hosted a couple of weeks ago now, supporting Veterans Radio. Great day, a lot of good fellowship, camaraderie, raised a little money for Veterans Radio, and you can still do that by helping us stay on the air as we've now been for 20 years by donating, hey, whether it's $20 or $200 at veteransradio.org, very safe way to go and make your support known to Veterans Radio. We have a story about Medal of Honor recipient that he tells a great story, David Bellavia, about what it's like to actually be in the room with the president and get awarded the medal. So that's really the focus of that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about who controls the National Guard, an interesting little discussion arising out of Texas. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia. David, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is an extraordinary story and a unique story that you've told it a couple of times. There's a lot of media on this. But David, in 2004, was with a U.S. Army unit, the Ramrods, and they were on the pointy end of the spear at the Second Battle of Fallujah. David's squad, after 3 days of constant fighting, were checking at night a darkened house. I think it was the 10th house that the squad had gone in to try to clear, and all hell broke loose. Some of that was actually captured on film because there was an embedded reporter. Ultimately, David, as the staff sergeant, decided something's got to be done to protect the guys here, and he went in single-handedly, cleared the house. I think there were four insurgents who were killed and another that was severely wounded, but all of that action was done to get the fire that was raining down on his squad dealt with. And as the NCO, kind of, it was his call. He couldn't send anybody else in. This was something he had to do. And that's, to some extent, what they expected of Sergeant Bell, as he was affectionately known as. David, you've had a chance to recount this story a number of times, but before we get there, give us a little about why you joined the Army to begin with. Well, to some extent, you wanted to see if you measured up.
I really, you're absolutely right. I didn't understand that until, there's a lot of, you go through the Army in your youth and you don't really know what the world is like. And then you leave and you realize that ultimately in my life, that ultimately is the ultimate challenge of an adult, is Am I leaving my uniform in a better place than I got it? Am I making my community better? Am I making my organization better? Do I measure, am I needed? When we look at all the problems veterans go through when we get out, addiction, suicide, depression, it's all about whether or not they're needed. Do we have a purpose? Do we have validation? Is there someone out there that wants me as an integral part of a community and a team? And it's so hard to replace that fidelity.
In fact, in David's most recent book, Remember the Ramrods, An Army, Brotherhood, and War and Peace, one of the lines I wrote down when reading it was, quote, proving to yourself why you are needed in the fight. And I thought that really struck a chord.
And it wasn't really until 9/11 when I think the country and most family members of people that were in the military at the time, and veterans, I mean, even other, most of the Vietnam veterans I talk to, I get all my wisdom from the Vietnam generation. They've been through everything we've been through. They had families, they had jobs. We don't need to look at a magic eight ball when we look at our future. We look at the Vietnam generation and think, look at the way these men and women have conducted themselves. This is our future. They're wonderful examples of that. But when I talk to those Vietnam vets, many of them didn't even get appreciated until 9/11. 9/11 wasn't just a generational fight. 9/11 was a generational thank you to service, whether it was law enforcement, first responders, or Vietnam veterans and current members. So after 9/11 happened, all of our families became like soccer moms. You know, like they were so proud that we chose this, that the war was happening, but we made the decision to want to do this. And so that relationship with my dad and my service completely changed, as it did for many sons and dads after September 11th.
Oh, absolutely. And you were sort of an interesting enlisted in the Army kind of guy. You were a non-drinker. You were a studier. You were a writer. You had a young son that had had medical issues who you missed dearly. You were a different kind of non-commissioned officer as I read this and as I understand it. Can you explain to our listeners who maybe don't understand what the role of an NCO is to them?
Yeah, so the NCO is the backbone of the military. When we go to foreign countries and we try to rebuild, you know, armies, one of the things that Iraq and Afghanistan was sorely missing was an NCO corps, which is that connection between the officer and the enlisted soldier on the ground. As an NCO, I can only be judged by what my subordinates do better than me, that I have to be replaced. It's a necessity in our military that the current generation is more proficient and disciplined and professional than the previous generation. And so your job isn't to professionally goaltend the young kid coming up. Your job is to nurture it and break out that greatness inside of them. And well, once you realize that a leader is only judged by how their subordinates eclipse them.
You were in the Army for 6 years, I believe. And,
yes.
And your first book was House to House. And can you just talk a little bit about that, and then we'll roll into the current book, Remember the Ramrods.
And there really was no genre of book that talked about that small unit relationship in a deep dive as to what actually combat is like, trying to make it realistic, but also trying to show that this is, we've got to be super cautious when we go to war. And so how do we conduct ourselves? Are we living for people that we lost? Are we sacrificing and being a better individual because of people that we didn't bring home? Or are we going to be entombed by that and be a victim of that? And I think it takes sometimes 20 years for you to kind of look back and do an inventory and say, well, here are the mistakes I made. Here are the things that are working out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
And I want to point that out, that it was in November of 2004 when the Second Battle of Fallujah is raging and you have to ultimately clear this house. That activity initially got you the award of the Silver Star, which was subsequently upgraded to the Medal of Honor in 2019. But you wrote House to House in 2007. So it's just 3 years after this, and the time for reflection, the time to maybe see all of the impacts of that trauma from war, maybe hadn't all come to the surface yet, David.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's a lot. Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, it was such a weird experience to I never knew that I was nominated for the Medal of Honor. It was the media that was telling everyone in 2004, 5, 6 that I was nominated for the Medal of Honor. So I didn't really I thought it was going to happen. It was just a matter of time. These are big investigations. Then I hear about this reporter who filmed the event, and there's a tape out there. And now I'm thinking, well, what's on the tape? Maybe what was on the tape was so horrible that, you know, it didn't work out with my version. But the Medal of Honor is an award that they don't interview. They don't care what you think you saw or did. The only thing that can go in a Medal of Honor award process is what other people witnessed. So if you engage two individuals, but no one saw it happen, it didn't happen. It's not in the citation.
Absolutely.
The only thing that's in the citation is the evidence of something that happened from two people, not one, but two. So you need two witnesses. So my biggest problem was that, you know, what had been witnessed was only on a tape with a foreign journalist. And you know, I figured, well, this is just, it's never going to happen. It's not the end of the world. My award was coming home and being with my family.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah.
No, the mere fact that this Australian journalist was embedded and was helps demonstrate the chaos under which everybody is operating. I think it's really helpful for the general public to understand this isn't the Medal of Honor isn't something you raise your hand and say, I'd like to get, and I did really cool stuff.
So the tape is 29 minutes long. A documentary that he made, Only the Dead, that went on HBO, and that's really the 5-6 minutes that he put in that documentary. But it was apparent to me, and you know, the Army doesn't tell you anything about the process. It's very opaque. It's very cloak and dagger. You don't know who voted, who did what, who said. You're kept out of everything. But it's very apparent to me that people saw the full tape, and the questions that came from the Army and the investigations that are done, that someone had access to that because they have information that no one really would have. And it is certainly not from my book, and it's not from me. It's from what was on the tape. So in a way, it's a weird experience to know that the world is watching something that you thought didn't, they're watching the videotape of you and you didn't know it existed. And then at the same time, you realize, well, without that videotape, my unit, my friends, myself, none of us get the recognition without that videotape. So it's that double-edged sword that, you know, we love Michael Ware because of what he did and what he provided for our unit.
One of the things that people I don't think understand, again, that this is not something you volunteer to be a Medal of Honor winner, a recipient, and unfortunately most of them do it and end up deceased as a result of their activity. But usually there's somebody promoting this on your behalf. Was it the Army? Was it somebody at the unit level? Was it journalists? How did, and I kind of refer to them as the Medal of Honor Sherpas, somebody helps carry this package through this elaborate process, and you might come out the other end of that process, but somebody does a whole lot of work, don't they?
They do. And honestly, the question I get asked the most is, if you could do it all over again, would you do it? And my answer is no, 100% no. And I don't mean that because I don't love my guys. I don't love, you know, my Army. This is way too much to put on one person to be the only living recipient of a war that had 4 million American men and women fighting in is not at all reasonable. It's unsustainable. There's way too many boxes that you could be put in. You get a lot of, it's just not something I ever wanted for myself. Honestly, I wouldn't want it for someone else either. So it's not a fun process, and it's not something you wake up every day and think, wow, this is so great. I'm going to coast through life. It's actually a burden that is more difficult than serving. I'd rather have an apartment in Fallujah than wear this thing every single day, because the expectations are unrealistic of what you expect to see from a recipient. But you're absolutely right. There are always people. And again, and so mine was Doug Walter, who was my company commander. My other commander was killed in Fallujah, and that was Sean Sims. So knowing that Sean Sims, you know, before he died, acknowledged that this was something that was worthy of attention, knowing that, you know, journalists and other people were telling this story. Sometimes that story gets out of control and it's not really what happened, but it's a good story. And sometimes the Army kind of wants to promote things that aren't exactly, you know, based in 100% reality. But Walter, Doug Walter and Peter Smith and Peter Newell and my division, they all were like, hey, you know, I know it's been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but put this thing up against anything you're currently looking at. And I don't think until that videotape or documentary comes out there that I don't think people believed it, honestly. I mean, we get a lot of people tell stories, and sometimes the fish is 2 inches long, and sometimes at the end of 10 years, that fish is a whale.
We call that false failure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So maybe people didn't believe it. It was too unbelievable. Everyone wants something out of the recipient, because if the recipient says the policy has failed, it gives it more credibility somehow, and it doesn't make sense. It's not real. The Vietnam guys had 80, you know, peers from different sides of the fight over, you know, 10 years. The Afghanistan guys are 22 of them from all over, from 2002, and the SEALs and Army and Marines. And there needs to be more recipients from Iraq so that we can tell the entire story of what our generation did at war. And when all this attention came my way, I thought, you know, I went through it with these guys. What is it that we're all missing? For years, I thought that I missed the war. I thought war was what I needed in my life to feel complete and whole. And it dawned on me going through this process that the war isn't what I miss at all. I miss the people. I miss the men. I miss the relationships. I miss the sense of purpose and obligation and duty. And I can have that again without going to war. I can have those relationships again. Why? What am I afraid of? Why not make this award about all of us? Why not get back to what we were? And if they're open to it, and they were, and the vast majority of these guys were like, I miss you. And I can say things to you at 40 I couldn't say at 20. We don't say we love each other when we're 20. We're too tough. But at 40, you can say you love another man. I miss you and I love you. Give me a hug. And that's where we're at in middle age, is we're able to tell each other how we feel. We miss each other. We want each other to be back. And it was such a healing, cathartic experience. And I thought to myself, you know, all these books that people write as veterans, this is a good news story. We don't have to be alone. We don't have to go through these things alone. You're still an NCO. Go out there and be with your soldiers. Lead your soldiers again. Bring them together. Call them up. Have them in your life. And if they're struggling, help them back up just like you did, you know, 20 years ago.
There is really the message, David, that I got out of the book, and why the book is subtitled An Army Brotherhood in War and Peace. That's the message I think is powerful in Remember the Ramrods, is if you were in service and you had those connections, or you were the NCO, or you were the commander, get off the couch and reconnect with these guys. It's going to be fantastic. And your reunion, if you will, was kind of around the Medal of Honor ceremony, which is obviously extremely unique. But talk about how those 40 men came back together and began, maybe began healing, but certainly added to the healing that had been going on.
Well, first of all, when you reach out, we're all different. We are different socioeconomic backgrounds. We cancel each other's vote. We root for the different teams on Sunday. You know, we are a cross-section of America. And yet we seem to get along. We seem to be able to work together. We disagree. We're passionate, but we love each other and we respect each other. And so I thought my entire destiny on this planet was to lead men in war, lead men across an objective. And when time goes by, you realize, well, your destiny is to be in someone's life, to impact their life. And they have such a huge, profound impact on my growth, on my matriculation to civilian life, on how, what kind of a father I am, what kind of a man I am. I would not be the person I am if it wasn't for the Army and it wasn't for the soldiers I served with. And it's tough to be getting a phone call out of 15 years later and saying, do you want to come to Washington and celebrate an individual? Do you want to, all the stuff that you want to put in a box, you threw it in your barn, you close the door, you put it in a time capsule. Do you want to unleash all of that and celebrate one guy? And if that's the way it was sold to them, I'm not sure I would want to do it. So we had to make this about us. This is not an individual award. It's a unit award. And I'm not just going to stand up there and you're going to clap. You're going to come on the stage with me. You're going to meet the president with me. You're going to be a part of everything I do. I'm going to have 40 guys and girls that I serve with and the parents of the fallen and the children of the fallen. And we're all going to do this as one big group. And that's how that was a promise I made when I brought them out there. And that's what we ended up doing. And it was such an amazing healing experience. They trusted me. And we're back in each other's lives now. And it's beautiful.
Well, this, your book portrays a lot about the backside of the Medal of Honor ceremony, which we in the general public get to see maybe a little news clip. Maybe we'll watch it longer on YouTube. But you really peel it back and say how you were feeling, what you were seeing, what you were doing. I want to comment on a couple of these things, that nuggets that you revealed, and maybe you want to comment on a couple of more. President Trump, who awarded this in June of 2019, before he signed the citation, asked you, do you want me to do this? What was your response?
I don't know. I didn't want anything to do with this. I've said no so many times that they had to break out. They had to break out my enlistment contract, and the enlistment contract is specific about the inactive ready reserve, the types of things
right,
the Army
right,
can do.
They can call you back. Yep, yep.
And it's small print. It's the recipient of the Medal of Honor. You can't say no. And so I was. Yeah, I didn't want it. I knew everything was going to change, and I was comfortable. I was comfortable in my little, I loved my life, and it was void of that time.
David's got these three kids. He's successful in the radio business. He's what they call talent. I'm not. He is. You didn't need this. And I thought it was funny that you reported out, hey, I told him no, but, he did it anyway. Your troops, your men, and brings you all the way to this ceremony. So it was an interesting arc that somebody said, hey, we ought to track that down if we can.
It was an incredible. They put a tremendous amount of research. They found the guy. He's a wonderful man. I'm just saying, I'm a grown man. Just tell me I found your recruiter. Don't build this up where the president of the United States is like, we got a big surprise for you. What is that big surprise, sir? It's your recruiter. Maybe a little bit of a Debbie Downer at that. But he was a wonderful guy, and it did. It showed this guy put me in the Army, gave me this opportunity, gave me an incredible trajectory. I learned so much. I love Sergeant Reyna, and I love the Army, so I appreciate him.
Well, one of the other things, again, we in the public see this, there's a row of generals always and secretaries of defense or Army or whoever. In your instance, as I said, you had a lot of the ramrods, maybe I think it was 40 guys and family members, your family members. You have this big audience of 300 looking at you. But your boys kind of took it to a new level, didn't they? They were enthusiastic. Why don't you tell everybody about that?
These Ramrods, I love these men. These guys are tough. They are. You don't want to mess with the 1st Infantry Division in a fight. They're salt of the earth, the fabric of America, from all city, rural, suburban, all walks of life, all demographics, ethnicities, sexualities. We got them all. They're beautiful, beautiful men. But my God, they turned that ceremony is very sterile. And it's like, this is all formal. And
I think the word the White House would say is solemn, not sterile.
It's solemn. It's solemn. It is a solemn ceremony. And they turned it into a rally. They turned it into, it was like a promotion ceremony outside the barracks. Like I was putting
with,
on
with,
another
with roster. Alcohol, with alcohol served.
With way too much alcohol served. And these guys were, and because you know that, you know, there's a cross section of our military. These guys are physically fit. They like their drink. They're rough guys. They're kind guys. They're wonderful people. But in the White House, they were back at the barracks and they were loud and they were getting into it, and it turned everything sideways. And I thought General Milley and the chiefs of staff were going to lose their mind, and they embraced it. They embraced it. And I was so grateful for that, because, you know, when Milley gets upset, you know, those eyebrows, he gets angry and he'll turn on you, you know, but he gave us permission to be what we are. And it was a cool experience.
Well, and you report in the book, you write in Remember the Ramrods, that's that unusual energy played right into President Trump, who seems to get himself energized when the crowd's energized, and this turned from a solemn occasion to really a celebration, which it should be anyway.
Well, that's what Trump was like in front of. He was like at a rally. And once he started feeding off the crowd and the crowd was laughing, he's walking to the crowd. He's high fiving people. He's, you know, I mean, he literally took it to a whole new level. But my guys responded to it. And it was just it's such a you forget that it's on TV and you forget that everyone's watching it. But as the citation's being read, I'm looking at these guys' faces, and the one thing I wasn't expecting is that, you know, I kind of forced them to go back in time, and not a lot of these guys necessarily wanted to. They wanted to be with each other, that we wanted to be a unit again. We wanted that camaraderie, but we weren't all prepared to go back to war. And I started to see that on a stage in front of millions of people. I started to see that these guys are all going back with me. And the willingness to do that for me was one of the most selfless acts. Right back to the war, these guys risked their lives for me, and now they're willing to put themselves back in a horrible time just to be there with me. It meant the world to me. It touched my heart, and it made me appreciate the Ramrods more than ever.
As I said, this ceremony is very solemn. Normally, the generals are there, the secretaries are there. In your instance, there were 7 living Medal of Honor attendees, which is really unusual. High praise. This is an elite group of men who've done extraordinary things of valor. But I have talked to Medal of Honor recipients in the past who reveal that, you know, maybe I was a little drunk during the ceremony. I was so nervous. I had to have maybe more than I should have. You have a similar story to calm your nerves. You took a little dip. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I'm not a drinker, and I've never been one of those guys. But when you are going back into a wormhole, you know, I was a big cigarette and tobacco user when I was in the war, and obviously I quit and I didn't need that anymore. But when I put the uniform back on, I felt like the uniform wasn't complete without the tobacco. I needed to get back into that. That was who I was back then. I needed to get back into character. So one of my friends, Fitz and Knapp, they gave me some Copenhagen, and I just threw a chaw in. And it's like, wow, I miss this. This is incredible. And before I know it, the president's like, let's go. And I'm like, sir, I've got a giant wad of tobacco in my mouth. And he's like, you're not going to go out there with tobacco in your mouth. I'm like, well, what are my options here, Mr. President? I don't know what to do. He's like, if you don't spit on my carpet. And I'm like, I'm not going to spit on your carpet, I promise you. But all the photos of that ceremony, all these people came up to me and still do and say, like, I looked at your face and you look so emotional. You look so stressed. You look so like you were in a tough spot. I said, you know, honestly, I was just thinking, don't swallow this juice because you're going to vomit on national TV. Yeah. I had so much juice in my mouth that I didn't know what to do with it. So I just kind of like slowly started to swallow a little bit at a time to get through it. But it was horrible. It was the worst. I never should have done it. And don't do tobacco products.
Well, there's a lot of vets who get a big laugh out of that because they can relate to having the chew at the wrong period of time and not having an outlet. Having received the award now in 2019, the Medal of Honor award, you've worn it for 3 years or so now. Can you talk to us a little bit about the responsibility you feel as a Medal of Honor recipient and maybe the weight that goes with being such a recipient?
It's heavy. I didn't know. Most of these guys are young when they get the award. And so the whole world is their oyster and everyone's going to go out and make different choices. I wanted to be the guy that went back in the Army. So I even though I was 40 and old, I went and said, use me. I don't know what to do with this thing. I don't want to go to Hollywood and be an action star. I don't want to take this and build. I want to put more people in the Army. So would you? And they were like, well, no one has ever offered us that. Like, we'll take you. And I'm like, great. So I went from the Medal of Honor stage in Washington, D.C. to basically 2.5 years all through COVID, just recruiting as many people as I possibly could, going from towns that have never seen a recipient or the award to talking to parents, talking to kids about reenlisting, going to ROTC graduations, and just literally 27 days a month on the road, not, you know, signing autographs and, you know, making speeches, but just talking to young people about this choice to serve and how important it is and how we're needed more than ever with all the threats that are in the world. And that was an incredible experience. And it meant so much to me to be back in, I'm a soldier again, you know, and it was like so much time had gone by, but yet it was like, it was yesterday. And, you know, but I did that. I loved it. And then I got out of that and I kind of went back to, now this is real. This is happening now. What do you do with it? And the key is that you just try to remind people that, you know, our country is worth any sacrifice. And this award doesn't represent me or my actions. It represents generations of blood, generations of sacrifice. You know, to get the Medal of Honor, it has to be witnessed. How many people in a trench line in World War I did something that nobody saw? How many people in Korea did something that nobody saw? That sacrifice is there. It's with us. We have to acknowledge it and genuflect to those generations, but at the same time, be reminded that this next group is going to be as lethal, as professional, and as disciplined as any previous generation. And these young kids, we could pile on the young generation and how irresponsible and they don't make their beds, but they are lethal and they are professional and they are decent, good men and women, and they are ready to do whatever this country asks them to do. And that is the new mission. Yep. And I'm proudly taking that mission on.
Well, I we're talking to David Bellavia, Medal of Honor recipient, still a very young man who's going to carry this weight throughout his life and continue to hopefully demonstrate to people the value of service, the value of service above self, and encourage those next generations. It's a great honor talking to you, David. Your current book, Remember the Ramrods, An Army Brotherhood in War and Peace, is much more reflective than House to House, his earlier book. And I think these, for those who want to get a better insight, they're both great reads. David, thanks for taking some time today with Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you for doing this program for as long as you have and doing it in the way you do it. You're giving voice to so many people. God bless you and much respect. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you. Getting the opportunity to talk to Medal of Honor recipients is certainly one of the highlights of being associated with Veterans Radio. I hope you enjoyed that interview and got some insight. I certainly enjoyed it and learned a lot. He's a great guy and gave us great insights. Let's have a few words from our additional sponsors, and then we'll get back to another story that raises this issue about, hey, who controls the National Guard?
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Professor Jason Mazzoni. Jason, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Now, let me set this up. The professor is a professor of law. Don't get scared off. He's a good guy. He is the Albert E. Jenner Jr. Professor of Law at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and director of the Illinois Program in Constitutional Theory, History, and Law. And he was brought to our attention by an interesting article, a recent article in the Army Times about who owns the National Guard, and a court decision down in Texas that will have some implications on that. But I should also say that Professor Mazzoni's, he got his undergraduate or master's, I guess it was, at Stanford University. He has his JD, his law degree from Harvard Law. He also picked up a master's in law at Yale Law School. So he's deep and wide in these legal issues, and we're going to drag him over to the military and veteran side. So, Jason, you ready to give this a try?
Yes, I am. Let's do it.
So, as I said, it's an interesting article that caught my attention in the Army Times, and it was over a lawsuit filed, as I understand it, by the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, over his legal fight against the Pentagon's requirement for COVID-19 vaccines. And
right.
he didn't want his Texas National Guard folks to have to comply with the federal requirement. And that's sort of the jump start of this dispute, isn't it?
That's right. So Governor Abbott sued the Biden administration to block it from enforcing, by punishing members of the Texas Guard, this vaccination, COVID vaccination requirement, as you said, Jim. Abbott's position was an interesting position. He said, so long as the Guard has not been mobilized by the federal government, so long as it's not in federal service, the federal government, particularly the president as commander-in-chief, lacks authority under the Constitution to punish guardsmen for failure to follow a federal order, in this case the vaccination requirement. Under the Constitution, that power is reserved to the state, and particularly in this case to the governor, to impose a punishment in the form of a fine or a discharge or a court-martial. If you mobilize the Guard, then yes, you, President, can impose a punishment for failure to be vaccinated. But until that happens and the Guard is just under normal state oversight, there's no authority, Abbott said, under the Constitution for the Commander-in-Chief, the president, to impose any sort of punishment against guardsmen for failure to comply with a federal directive.
So you see how this issue, I don't know if it's political or social issue between the governor and the president over something that was controversial, the COVID vaccines, gets in played here. And the professor mentioned numerous times, it's a constitutional issue. Who's got the power? Now, we all know, anybody who's served and been around the military knows that when you're on active duty, it's the president. He's the commander-in-chief. But the National Guard in all 50 states really report up to the governor of that state, who's in charge and the commander-in-chief. And it's more important today than ever as we come off our 20-year war in Afghanistan. There's about 1.4 million active duty members in the U.S. military, but there are 450,000 active guardsmen in the states. So that adds to the strength of the military by about 32%, and they were all used pretty much in Afghanistan. So you see that this isn't a small issue. It's kind of, while it's a little wonky, Professor, it's like a real issue of who's in charge, and what did the courts say about this?
Well, so this was filed in federal district court by the governor. The governor lost in federal district court. He then appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is the intermediate federal appellate court. It's one step below the U.S. Supreme Court. And there, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit agreed, at least at this stage of the case, it's still in a preliminary stage of the case where Abbott is seeking an initial order blocking any punishment against guardsmen. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit disagreed with the conclusion of the lower court, the district court, and suggested that its view was that Abbott had a quite good legal argument under the Constitution, sent it back down to the district court for it to reassess its prior order with a pretty strong hint that Abbott should prevail at least this stage of the case, where, again, he's seeking a preliminary order to keep things as they are, to maintain the status quo, to prevent the federal government from punishing any members of the Guard while the case proceeds in the federal courts. And so, you know, where things stand at this point, it's before the trial court again, but following this pretty strong suggestion from the Court of Appeals, the intermediate appellate court in the federal system, that Abbott's claim has some real merit, that the president, the Department of Defense, lacks authority until guardsmen are actually mobilized to discharge them, order court-martial them, or to fine them, or to do anything else by way of punishment. And the circuit court's reasoning was based upon these old provisions of the Constitution that don't say anything about the National Guard, because there was no such thing when the Constitution was drafted, but they refer to the militia and who controls and has power over the militia under the original Constitution. The court took the view that the Guard is equivalent to the old militia, and so those militia provisions of the Constitution that divide power between the national government and the states, that they apply to the Guard today in the same way that they apply to the militia. And the circuit court said, you know, if we look at these provisions, yes, the federal government has certain powers, but it said the power to provide for governing the militia only belongs to the national government when guardsmen are in federal service. And the power to govern includes the power to punish. And so a kind of straight up plain reading of the text of the Constitution, the circuit court said, means that until there is mobilization of guardsmen, in the same way as would have been true with respect to the militia, the power to impose punishment is one that belongs to the state. If you want to punish, you have to wait, federal government, until you've actually called the Guard, or in a historical case, the militia, into federal service. That's what the Constitution says.
Well, and that's the issue that kind of dragged Professor Mazzoni into this from the University.
Oh, this is great stuff. I mean, this is, you know, so you might think, oh, this is a kind of specialized issue today, but historically, you know, control over the militia, this is one of the biggest issues of the Philadelphia Convention, right? This sort of concern about national security and how you're going to make sure that you have sufficient security personnel, kind of concern about a large standing
Army, and so instead of that, we'll allow the national government to deploy the militia in certain circumstances. But we're concerned about that because the militia is really an entity under state governmental and local governmental control. So we have to be very careful about the circumstances under which we're going to allow the national government to exercise authority over those old militia forces. And this is the kind of compromise that has worked out at the Constitutional Convention, you know, 1787, gets adopted as part of the Constitution within the next 2 years. And here we are today, you know, talking about essentially the same question, but in the context of COVID vaccines, which, of course, nobody had thought about in the 1780s, but really raising the same basic question, who gets to decide? Who's in charge? Here the court says, well, the Constitution tells you.
Well, and it is relevant today, and that's kind of why the article caught my attention, and I wanted to talk to Professor Mazzoni, who has researched and written a lot on this issue of the militia clause that was quoted by the court, which is always a nice thing, you know, makes you feel good that somebody thought your work was...
I live for that. I mean, yeah. That's what law professors live for, yes.
But it's relevant today, not only because of this COVID dispute, but those of us who've been around for a while can think back when we were required to take the anthrax vaccine.
Right.
And there was a lot of dispute about, hey, I'm not going over there. Why am I taking this? And I can project it forward by saying we have a lot of states that allow marijuana use, and both medically and recreationally, but the federal government doesn't. So who gets to decide whether somebody gets disciplined because they test positive for marijuana? And
right.
So this issue is going to go on for a while.
That's right. And you know, most of the time, as you said at the outset, the federal government and the states, the president and the governor, are basically on the same page. But the issues emerge when they're not. When the governor of a state, as here with respect to Governor Abbott, thinks that there's a kind of punishment being imposed that is unwarranted. So that's really where these sorts of issues can emerge. And when they do emerge, they can be really important. I mean, this question of whether the federal government can actually impose this directive against militiamen or National Guardsmen who are not yet in federal service for failure to do what? Failure to obtain a COVID vaccine, an issue as to which there was, of course, a great deal of controversy.
And the government argued in this case, as I understand it, at the Fifth Circuit, hey, we, the federal government, give these state national guard troops plenty of money and plenty of training when they're not federalized, and therefore, because we give the money, we get to control the strings that go with it. I'm sure that's an oversimplification, but wasn't that the basic argument?
That's absolutely right. The government had several arguments, but one of the arguments, as you point out, Jim, is, look, we're paying for this, right? Yes, we understand the distinction between guardsmen who have not been mobilized and those who have, and we certainly understand that as a distinction. But even when guardsmen are not yet in federal service, they're being supported significantly through federal dollars. And if we're paying, we should be able to call the tune. As a condition of you, state, receiving this money for your National Guard, we are attaching this requirement that they be vaccinated. And the circuit court said, there are lots of circumstances in which the federal government can give out money to states and attach various sorts of conditions to those grants. We see this a lot in the context of education and so on, where the federal government makes financial grants to states and says, if you want the money, here's what you got to do in return. But the circuit court said that condition, though, that is attached cannot be a violation of the Constitution. And here, the government is essentially saying to the states, you must do something that itself is not permitted under the Constitution. And so that's a limit on the ability of the federal government to impose conditions upon federal grants. You cannot require militiamen to be vaccinated unless they're, guardsmen to be vaccinated unless they're in federal service. And you cannot impose that as a condition on a grant either because you can't force the states to agree to things that violate the Constitution as a condition of receiving money. And so the government lost on that point as well.
So there's a veteran radio listeners, Professor Jason Mazzoni at the University of Illinois, just gave you the synopsis of the first year of constitutional law and a very expensive education. You can't put conditions on that violate the Constitution. Seems simple when you say it like that.
It's a basic principle. You don't get to bribe people to get around constitutional limits.
Now, I'm going to back up a little bit because this is such a unique little area. But how the heck did you get so interested in the militia clause and research and writing it that you find your way into the Fifth Circuit opinions?
I've always been interested in the security elements of the Constitution. When we teach constitutional law, as we do to first year students, spend a lot of time talking about government powers and individual rights and so on. And it struck me when I first started teaching that a large theme of the Constitution is national security. If you sort of think about a dominant theme in the document, that's what it is, that there are provisions throughout the Constitution that anticipate that there will be national security problems on the horizon and provide for some kind of effective response to that. Today, of course, we don't often think about the country being at risk of being invaded and or subject to internal insurrections and other kinds of security challenges. But for Americans of the 1780s, this was the thing that they thought a lot about, invasion or individuals in the country who were waiting to topple the government. And they built a constitution that anticipated that there would be national security challenges and anticipated the need to have an effective response to them. And central to the design that was created was, as I said earlier, this division of authority over the militia in a context in which you had minimal professional soldiers, and there was a general concern about a large standing army. The militia was supposed to be your principal fighting force. And so there are lots of provisions throughout the Constitution that deal with this issue of the role of the militia in with respect to national security, and the more important question of who gets to direct the activities of the militia. So this is a big theme of the original Constitution, and in some ways it captures many of the concerns that were in play at the time the Constitution is adopted, concerns about division of power between the national government and the state, questions about the role of ordinary Americans, because that's essentially what the militia was in security operations and in the operations of government more generally. And so these are sort of old provisions that were very important in the 1780s, and as to which I think you can learn a great deal about the Constitution in general if you kind of dust them off and think about them. And then occasionally you get an exciting case like the one out of the Fifth Circuit that actually talks about the militia, which, it's kind of unheard of. There are very few cases in which you get an extensive historical discussion. So these things that you sometimes think are no longer relevant can actually, as here, turn out to be incredibly important still.
So somebody out there is thinking, and certainly the government attorneys did, that said, hey, the Constitution talks about a militia. It has nothing to do with the National Guard. It doesn't look like the National Guard. It's a totally different concept. You can't take that archaic idea from the 1780s and bring it forward. What say you, Professor?
I think there's something really to be said about that.
There you go. Only a law professor would see the fun of it. Jason Mazzoni, professor of law, we really appreciate you taking the time to help us understand the controversy of who's really in charge of the National Guard and who gets to set those kind of rules. If this continues on, I'm sure we'll be talking again. But again, thanks for your time today, Jason.
My pleasure, Jim.
Hope you enjoyed that discussion with Professor Mazzoni. Not a day goes by that you don't hear about a controversy between the federal government and state governments, particularly the Biden administration and Abbott's administration down in Texas, because of the inflow of illegal aliens, and what role can the National Guard play down there, and when does it cross over, and the federal government's in charge. So these are discussions that go on maybe at the highest levels that we don't think about. But there are legal, there are constitutional issues, and some of those have to be sorted out by the court. As Professor Mazzoni indicated, this will probably end up in the Supreme Court at some point to sort of sort this issue out a little bit. And is today's National Guard really the same as the militia talked about in the Constitution? As we come to wrap this up, I'm Jim Fossone. I'm a veterans disability lawyer with Legal Help for Veterans, as well as veteransradio.org's podcast host. So we're glad to bring this to you. And we want to thank Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, as well as the VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 and the American Legion Press Corps Post 46. We can't do this without that kind of support. You can support us by going to veteransradio.org and donating away. We'd really do appreciate every little bit that you give us as we look to expand our coverage and expand our content that we give you. And if you've got some content that you'd like us to interview people with or delve deeper into a particular subject, send Dale or myself a email at dale@veteransradio.org or jim@veteransradio.org. We'd love to do that and get on the air those programs that you're interested in having. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.